I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and causing God to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a part of diabetes. If you don't love it, leave it. But this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in the fog of darkness. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. With lots more news and views for our people. We've got a lot to talk about today in the show. And I'm going to start off with a disturbing news report from Rebel Media. Ezra Levant's online news service. He's a Zionist, but he does some good work, and he is for free speech. He sure doesn't like the Muslim invasion of Canada, and his outfit has done a great report on the invasion coming across the border, mostly into Quebec. Just a few highlights. I'm going to play the news item, but just a few highlights. It makes it clear that the people pouring in are now, many are from Haiti. And he says they're very well dressed. Now, most of their men, it's about 70% men. You know, normally refugees would be more women and children. They're well dressed for the most part. Some of them have pocket loads of money. And several cell phones. You know, not the your poor, tired, huddled masses of the disgusting Emma Lazarus poem. And as I mentioned, well-dressed, many tool up to the American side of the border in a taxi. Some on their luggage have tags that show they've come from Tampa. Well, that's not surprising. They're Haitians. Lots of them are in the Florida area. And when they're asked, many are fairly frank. They're coming up here for better welfare, for Medicare. Some don't want to go back to their home country for fear of actually having to serve in the army. Well, okay, if somebody isn't prepared to serve in the army of their own country, I mean, what do we need them for? The farce gets even worse, if possible. At the border, they're met by the RCMP, who help them with their luggage, ask them if they're carrying any weapons, give them a very cursory pat-down, not the sort of crackdown you, as a Canadian citizen, would be given if you're searched before going on a plane in your own country. These people are illegal. They are then picked up by the RCMP, who will assist them to get on a bus to take them to Montreal to be processed. Or I should say to begin the process as immigrants. To make a refugee claim. It is disgusting. The collaboration, as far as I'm concerned, fire the entire RCMP. They are useless. They might just as well stay in the nearest Tim Hortons and have coffee and donuts. Their job should be to keep these invaders out. See, they're crossing through fields. Now, you might say, well, why don't they build a wall? I mean, build a fence or a wall. Duh! Would it take a genius to think of that? Well, no. The trust fund kid, our prime minister, is too busy marching in gay pride parades and things like that to actually worry about our borders. And you see, they don't care. That's the big thing. He says we're the first postmodern country, post-national country rather, and we really don't have a political culture. Well, no, he doesn't recognize one because he's a white hater. He doesn't like a white culture. He can't replace the European founding settler people fast enough. He's all for this. He doesn't care where they come from, particularly as long as they come from the third world. He announced when President Trump made his first presidential orders there back in January that Canada was open for refugees. Well, it didn't take geniuses on the Jungle Telegraph to get the message. Canada's open? Oh, Canada's the good time had by one and all? Well, we're on our way. And they are. They're on their way, and Canada is in the process, I fear, of going down. Okay, now, what do we have here? In fact, I'm trying to get this here for you. There's a very good program today. Trying to find this thing here. Extremely good. Actually came from Stan Hess in the United States, and he calls this Camp of the Saints Comes to Canada. Sean Raspey's great book.
Last Monday, an estimated 500 border jumpers walked into Quebec, Canada through one illegal border crossing alone. During the next 24-hour period between Tuesday and Wednesday, 300 illegals walked that very same path. Now, Quebec officials say that the province is averaging 200 illegals per day. So it's been roughly 7 months since Prime Minister Justin Trudeau welcomed the world to claim refugee status right here in Canada. And with time, well, word has spread, and more people than ever are heeding his call. Today, Canada's southern border with the United States has been turned into a constant, revolving back door. Here at the Rebel.media, we have traveled across the country documenting this manufactured crisis over the last several months, from Manitoba, where we shared stories of young mothers who faced migrant men forcing their way into their homes at their doors at all hours of the night, and Quebec as well, where we spoke to illegals who told us that they were not fleeing President Donald Trump, as the mainstream media would have you believe, rather that they were dodging the draft in Eritrea or seeking socialized health care after flying in from Saudi Arabia. There, we also showed you the face of confessed human trafficking rings behind this fake refugee railway into Canada. Well, this week, I went back to the illegal border crossing at Watson Road, just one section of Canada's very long undefended border with the United States, which separates upstate New York from southern Quebec. And, well, I have an update. The changes that have taken place in the past 4 months since I was there last are alarming, if not wholly unbelievable. In the meters leading up to the illegal border crossing, what was once plain pavement has been transformed into a dumping ground. Everywhere, boarding passes from refugees, the sorts of refugees that can afford plane rides, I guess, coming in from places like West Palm Beach, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and Salt Lake City. Dirty diapers just disposed on the side of the street. Pieces of broken luggage with airline tags affixed to them. And, well, several condoms, both unopened and seemingly used. Then the border itself, an intersection that was, just 4 months ago, marked by a few police cruisers on the Canadian side and a ditch through which illegals would cross into RCMP bellhop pants. Well, today, it's laden with enormous refugee gazebo tents. Inside them, at least triple the police presence. A waiting area has been created to handle the long and constant queue of illegals before they are initially processed in the tents further back by even more RCMP officers. Also among the changes, in addition to many more federal police cruisers, there are now two more trucks. One, a shuttle bus, which is being run on a 24-hour load-and-go schedule, and a cube van for all the luggage these self-styled refugees have in tow when they cross. As for that small ditch, well, the illegals don't have to worry about getting their sneakers dirty anymore because Quebec taxpayers have subsidized a new land bridge, a welcome mat of sorts, to assist border jumpers in committing their crime. And an obvious but very necessary word on that before I carry on. Every single individual crossing that bridge is indeed a criminal. It's a matter of law. No one leaving the United States of America is a refugee. There is no persecution to flee in the U.S. It is the safest, freest country in the world. And both the U.S. and Canada, well, they acknowledge that fact in our signed Safe Third Country Agreement, which states that if someone is already in one of those countries, well, they can't just pretend to be a refugee fleeing to the other. And yet, more people than ever are doing just that, a lot more. So when the rebel was at Roxham Road back in April, we spoke to bus drivers, cab drivers, a human trafficker, and saw for ourselves that roughly 15 to 20 people per day were illegally walking into Canada. But today, that is the hourly rate. Roughly 15 people are illegally walking into Canada every hour throughout the day and the night. And that's just along this one road, never mind all the other known gateways across our country. We honestly hardly had a chance to return to our stakeout position in the car because there was just such an abundance of illegal border crossing activity. A steady stream of taxis shuttling individual men, groups of men, and some families. And during our time along the border this week, well, we clocked an average of 17 men for every 25 illegals that entered, placing the women and children ratio at about 30% of the total, with men occupying the lion's share of claims at about 70%. In the mornings, we'd arrive on the U.S. side to lineups, which had already formed in the earlier hours, stretching along both sides of the border, and at no point was there a period in which zero illegals were present on either side. Translation? The flow of illegal entry into Canada is quite literally constant. So, just who are these refugees, and are they coming from different countries in comparison to what we saw just 4 months ago? Yes, they are. It would appear that the Prime Minister's invitation is making the rounds worldwide. Whereas in April, the majority of the men that we spoke to were from Eritrea, Sudan, and Saudi Arabia, a point confirmed by locals and cab drivers. Well, this time, the majority of the border jumpers that were willing to talk to us, at least, said that they hailed from Haiti. Where are you from?
Haiti.
You're from Haiti? Yes. Where are you from?
Haiti.
Haiti. You're from Haiti.
Yes.
Well, where are you all from? Where are you from?
I see. Yeah.
The majority of the Haitians that we spoke to, by the way, spoke Creole, not one of our official languages, i.e. French. We also encountered men from as far as Myanmar. And finally, just one man who claimed he and his son were from Syria, but just insisted on speaking to me in Spanish.
I'm from Syria.
From Syria?
Yeah.
Wait, you're somewhere but in Syria are you from?
Excuse me, I don't speak English by the way.
Which city? Where are you? Raqqa? Where?
I can you speak Spanish?
Un poquito?
I don't
de
know.
Donde eres? No Syria?
No, soy de Syria. Soy de Siria, pero ya viví mucho tiempo en Venezuela y allá tiene muchos problemas. Llegan alguna gente para secuestrar a mi hijo. Entonces compré por aquí a Estados Unidos y quiero pasar a Canadá.
Individual stories vary between people who said that they were only passing through America to get to Canada's open border and others who said that they had been living in America for some time just illegally. Well, why are you leaving?
So that something wrong.
Something specific?
Yeah.
What's making you leave America?
I don't have paperwork. I don't have nothing. So you got a deportation. So that's it.
Now, a constant trend that we noticed was just how well dressed many of these so-called refugees were. Men who look more like rap stars than refugees, decked out with fancy headphones and chain necklaces, leather jackets, brand new tracksuits, and really clean shoes. One after another, we witnessed adult men exit taxis with flat-brimmed hats, fine luggage, and brand new cell phones, just before walking across the border and declaring themselves refugees. As for procedure, well, little has changed. While the migrants are in the process of committing their crime, an RCMP officer just stands there and tells them that their actions are in fact illegal, but places absolutely no physical barriers to entry. After the illegal entrance is made, the RCMP officer politely asks if they're armed, carrying any drugs or alcohol, and performs a very brief pat-down. No suitcases are examined whatsoever. In some instances, we witnessed RCMP officers clearly perplexed by the sorts of expensive goods these refugees are bringing into Canada with them. You catch that? A man in a sport jacket and leather shoes with a wad of cash in his pocket, not one, but two cell phones and a mobile internet hotspot device, is illegally walking out of America into Canada while claiming to be a refugee. And refugee possessions weren't the only thing to raise eyebrows on the ground. In some instances, we witnessed serious tensions between husbands and wives traveling together. In one case, a mother carrying her young child and luggage slipped and fell while crossing illegally. But rather than ensuring that she and the baby were all right, a man one would presume was the father proceeded to hit her on the head. So now that these people are here, what is Canada doing with them? Well, they're being shipped to Canada's sanctuary city, Montreal, or Olympic Stadium to be precise. Officials would not let the Rebel.media media enter the premises, stating that all media are banned, Canadian or otherwise. Beyond a certain line, only the migrants can enter. But even from a bird's eye view, it's really clear Canada is getting a little taste of Calais. But the locals we encounter don't seem to mind. On more than one occasion at the border, a refugees welcome group showed up with supportive signs and a megaphone articulating the now all too familiar slogan, "No one is illegal." And then this man, living mere steps away from the RCMP's refugee gazebos, Canada's border crisis is literally happening in his backyard, but he says he's not in the least bit bothered.
Do you ever fear for your family's safety as to who might be coming up through your backyard?
Not at all. I mean, these people are not criminals, you know. They're refugees, you know. They've had terrible, terrible hardship, I assume, you know. It's a tragedy. Can you imagine leaving everything behind, you know, to come to a place that you don't really know what's going to happen? I'm not sure I would do it.
The Canadian Border Services Agency Union Voss said that many of the people that he's processing do indeed have criminal records, including serious criminal records, things like trafficking and murder. Does that change your opinion whatsoever?
No, I'm not afraid. Why would I be afraid of, you know?
And he's not alone. Canada's Prime Minister isn't bothered either, despite calls from various levels of government and police services for more resources from across the country. Justin Trudeau says that Canada has the capacity to properly process all of these illegals currently rushing Canada's southern border and more. You know, it's going to be another 4 months before the snow sets in southern Quebec. So, considering just how severely the crisis has escalated in the last 4 months, you really have to wonder, how many more fake refugees is Canada expected to care for before Justin Trudeau considers closing our back door? For the Rebel.media, I'm Faith Goldie. The Rebel.media was the very first organization to actually care about this story, and we continue in our coverage. If you want to help support our journalism, please visit guardtheborder.com.
And that's a great production there by Ezra Levant, well done. And of course, just an absolute scandal. Well, I was talking yesterday about Ernst Sundell. Ernst Sundell passed away on Saturday at his home in Bad Wiesbaden, in southern Germany. That's in the Black Forest area. He was one of the giants of the revisionist movement for many, many years. Not an original researcher himself, but as a graphic artist and publisher, he published a lot of the really key works of a generation ago in revisionist history. Particularly, he circulated widely in Canada the monograph by Richard Verrall, Did 6 Million Really Die?, which was not the first, but one of the early and key work studies that questioned the new religion of Holocaust, particularly on the numbers. And Ernst, of course, got into a lot of legal trouble, tremendous harassment by the Jewish lobby in Canada, dragged through the courts for 9 years, some of those under severe bail conditions. 9 years. Now, this would have broken or deterred the average man. He actually won the case. The law, the false news law, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of Canada. Then we moved in the 90s into the internet age, or the age with what were then called discussion boards. We call them today web pages. And one of the early ones was called the Zundel site. And it published a lot of Ernst's ideas, and then it was actually run in the United States by a woman who had become his wife, Ingrid Rimland, and of course Ingrid Sundell eventually. It was then attacked under Canada's old, repealed, but that was the Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. Then there was the Zundel site case went from 1997 to 2002, and CAFE was an eager participant. Ernst had twice been turned down for Canadian citizenship, the final time in, I believe, early 2000, on the basis that he was a threat to national security. Now, he had never broken Canada's laws. He had never, in fact, the one time that they attempted to convict him, the Supreme Court overturned the conviction. So he was an employer. He'd been a reliable taxpayer, a law-abiding citizen, very typical of so many Germans. He certainly paid his dues. He'd been a positive contribution to this country. Anyway, the government decided, largely under pressure from the Jewish lobby, to declare him a threat to national security. On what basis? Well, he was a purveyor of hate propaganda, which is kind of a loosey-goosey term. He was never charged under Canada's laws for, even under our notorious section 319 of the Criminal Code, the so-called hate law. He was never charged, obviously never convicted. It was simply that he published material that certain powerful people didn't like, and that had him declared a threat to national security. Well, that doesn't fit. That is, of course, what many of the newspapers today, some with some degree of objectivity, others were just gloating at his demise, have reported that he was found to have been a threat to national security. Well, fortunately, the CSIS Act, that's Canadian Security Intelligence Service Act, which explains what a threat to national security is, gives us a pretty good definition. A threat to national security is somebody who, for one thing, is controlled by a foreign power. Like, maybe the Israeli lobby? No, not them. Okay, so you're working for a foreign power. Or something involved in espionage. So you're spying for a foreign power and giving our secrets to them. Okay, that's clearly a threat to national security. Or you advocate or practice the attempts to overthrow, the violent overthrow. Now, that's not the change. The violent overthrow of the government of Canada or any province. Okay, so that would be a threat to national security. Yeah, that makes sense. And finally, people who perpetrate serious acts of violence against persons or property. Now, the emphasis there is serious. A street punch-up is not a serious act of violence. It's an act of violence, but that's considered more a matter for the local police, and rightly so. So, serious acts of violence against persons or property. That is what a constitutes a threat to national security. So, how did Ernst, who clearly wasn't working for a foreign power, wasn't involved in espionage, wasn't advocating the violent overthrow of the government of Canada or any province, never been involved in acts of serious violence, or actually any acts of violence at all. He was the victim, though, of at least two bomb attacks on his home, an arson in 1995 that cost almost $400,000 damage, and was perpetrated by the Jewish Defense League, by Irv Rubin. He said so. He said so in the hearing. He said so actually in a boast to a woman I know in the United States about a decade ago. So Ernst was frequently the victim of violence. He's not a perpetrator of violence. So the finding of a threat to national security clearly bent the normal meaning of those terms beyond all recognition. But then, as Ernst often said, there's one law for everybody else, and then there's another law for Ernst. The Canadian justice system quite often was disgusting in the way it treated this man.
Again.
And let's, you know, shake our heads out about this for the non-violent expression of his political views. Non-violent. And he was treated abominably. Okay, finally in 2000, he gave up. He said Canada basically was a lost cause, and I'm sorry he felt that way. I mean, this is my country, so I guess I'm going to fight for it. But with some justification, he felt he'd had it with Canada. He'd done his best, and by this time he was married to Ingrid Rimland, of course now Ingrid Sundel, living. She sponsored him to immigrate, and normally a husband there'd not be a problem for a husband to join his wife, all things being equal. And so Ernst sought to join her. He went through the immigration process. Things were looking good. He had got a FBI interview as usual. He had the let me see, the FBI interview, fingerprinting, of course, health test, made sure he didn't have AIDS, and so on and so on. And he was had only one more interview to go, and he was supposed to go with his lawyer. And the lawyer was unable to make it. So a couple of days before, the lawyer contacted the immigration, the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization folks, and explained that he could not make it, and could they arrange for another date. And this is routine. This is not an unusual thing. This is totally routine. So he didn't hear back. So he faxed them again. And Ernst was a bit nervous. Shouldn't I go anyway? And he said, no, this is pretty normal. Dates conflict, things happen. Don't worry, I've informed them, and they'll get back to us. I think a few months went by, and then I believe it was in February of 2003, knock, 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 knock. Sheriff's deputies and INS people and all armed descended on Ernst Zundel's place just outside Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Arrested him, handcuffed him, wouldn't even let him take his medicine or contact his lawyer, hauled him off to jail, and within 2 weeks he was deported back to Canada, his country of last legal residence. So I'm going to continue the story after a short musical interlude here. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Going to play a really, I find this really emotional. It's a, this is a tribute to Ernst Zundel. I mean, the music's a tribute to him. Hope you like it. It's actually the a German march played for dead soldiers, and he really was the soldier in the battle for freedom of speech and for the honor of his country. And I will be coming back to the Ernst Zundel story right after our short musical interlude, which we are hoping will start. Thank you. moving tribute to our symbols for fallen soldier in the battle for truth. And great way, I hope, to pipe this fine man home. I'm going to play a couple more tunes in this short musical interlude here. I think, we couldn't do better than this lovely lady. I met her in Nashville, Tennessee. She was really the voice of Highway 101 in the late 80s, early 90s. Paulette Carlson, beautiful blonde from Minnesota, Somewhere Tonight. That's Paulette Carlson, and another one by Paulette Carlson. She wrote this last year. Her part in the campaign, she backed Donald Trump, and this is called I'm Playing Trump. And great song.
Faith in one man now.
Sadly,
oh, so many others.
The American dream is dead.
It's not so easy, but it's all or nothing. The odds are stacked, but I've got to stand for something. People talking like he's no good.
be running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
Yes, it's all but over, this game we play. You've been feeling from the bottom, I've been losing every day. Now I can see where I could finally
no power except that granted it by the people. It is time to check and reverse the growth of government, which shows signs of having grown beyond the consent of the governed.
Paulette Carlson. I'm playing Trump, and this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. So, when we left off on the story, Ernst had been deported back to Canada. This was in February 2003. You might have thought that he'd been a landed immigrant in Canada since 1958, that it would simply be a matter of his resuming his life in Canada. But no, the then Minister of Immigration, a man by the name of Denis Coderre, he's now Mayor of Montreal, when he was asked what he was going to do about Ernst Zundel, because of course the Jewish lobby was making a great deal of noise about him. They didn't like him because he questioned the new religion of Holocaust. Denis Coderre, who's a little pipsqueak of a guy with a Wayne Newton type hairdo, cocked his thumbs in his belt and said, "Just watch me." Well, okay. We just watched him, and so he slapped Zundel with a little-used law aspect of the law that had come into place late in 2001 as part of our reaction to 9/11. And it was called a National Security Certificate. And what it meant was that if you are not a Canadian citizen, so if you are a landed immigrant or a visitor, you can be deported from Canada if a minister of the Crown, two cabinet ministers actually, will sign a document, a certificate, saying you're a threat to national security. And as I was mentioning before the break, this national security business is quite explicit in law. However, people who don't really wish to interpret the law, but just make it up as they go along, or actually fulfill the desires of minority lobbying groups, they simply ignore the law. So anyway, what happens with a national security certificate is this. Two ministers of the Crown sign the certificate, and the victim is given the opportunity to actually appear before a specially designated judge. There are only a certain number of federal judges designated to hear these. They are apparently being people who are being vetted for themselves, not to be threats to national security. Victim will be, has to argue that somehow or another he's not a threat to national security. Well, you know, it's sometimes hard to prove a negative. To make matters worse, there is secret evidence, secret witnesses, and so the defense never gets the right that's guaranteed by English common law to be able to face his accuser. In some cases, there's what's called public evidence, but there's also secret evidence. And all that the victim gets is a general summary of what the evidence is, and sometimes does not even know who the witness is. Now, this is a complete violation of common sense and basic rights for several reasons. Number one, often a witness is subject to a challenge on credibility. You know, is the person who's saying this known to be the village idiot, or is this person otherwise credible? Well, if you don't know who the witness is, how can you even test the credibility? And of course, there's the matter of a court appearance. In court, you have a chance to test the witness's credibility, see the witness in action, and often a witness falls apart. Their evidence is seen not to be credible. So that of course is denied to the defense. We don't know what the secret evidence was, but the public evidence, and we did cross examine one CSIS agent, and it was a joke. The CSIS agent said that Ernst was a threat to national security. Well, he admitted that Ernst had never broken a Canadian law. Well, that kind of would seem to suggest, maybe he's not a threat to national security. Don't forget, a threat to national security would be somebody who promotes the violent overthrow of the government of Canada or a province, who's practiced a serious act of violence in the pursuit of his political or religious goals. Zundel did none of those. Is a person operating for a foreign power? Well, no, it's not the Israeli lobby. It's Ernst Zundel wasn't operating for any foreign power. Let me think. Espionage. Well, he wasn't spying for anybody or stealing government secrets. He didn't know any government secrets. Okay, so he doesn't really fit. So how did CSIS reason in public that Ernst was a threat to national security? Okay, well, something like this. Way back sometime in the 70s, Ernst Zundel attended several meetings sponsored by the National Alliance and heard Dr. William Pierce, who was the head of the National Alliance, which was a perfectly legal group in the United States. Ernst Zundel, it must be known, that never joined the National Alliance, though there would be no reason why he couldn't, and didn't, and never supported them, and never donated to them. So he heard two talks by William Pierce, okay? William Pierce wrote several novels. One of them was called The Turner Diaries. Allegedly, a man by the name of Timothy McVeigh read the Turner Diaries. And Timothy McVeigh blew up the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, allegedly. Therefore, Ernst Zundel was a terrorist and a threat to national security. You get it? Does it make any sense? No, it's ludicrous. And in any fair court, this would have been laughed out of the court, and the CSIS agents who brought this forth given a severe disciplining. But that's not the way it worked out. Okay, further problems. The person judging this was a man by the name of Pierre Blay. Pierre Blay was the former Solicitor General in the Conservative government, in the Brown Mulroney government. Now, as Solicitor General, he was responsible for the spy agency, CSIS. So he was their boss. So the former boss is going to be judging objectively, we hope, the evidence of his former employees. Well, it gets even more squirrely. His former employees, namely CSIS, probably know any skeletons that might be in Pierre Blais's closet. Now, I don't know what those skeletons are. Perhaps there are none. Perhaps there are. But we don't know that. That's what's called a reasonable apprehension of bias. Here is a man who is going to be supposedly judging objectively, the testimony of his former employees. Oh yes, former employees and people who might, well, because they're the Canada's spies, have something on him. That's what's called a reasonable apprehension of bias. Three times. Once with Doug Christie, that's Ernst Zundel's first lawyer, and then Doug had to drop out of the case because he was his wife was quite ill, so the second lawyer, Peter Lindsay, took over the case, and twice with Peter Lindsay, once with Doug Christie, and all the way to the Federal Court of Appeals, we got nowhere trying to get Judge Blais to recuse himself. And we think Judge Blais was sent in there simply as a hitman. That's right. That was his job, to get Ernst Zundel. And he did. He fulfilled his role. So, all the while, Ernst Zundel was kept in solitary confinement and for a while even denied dental care. He was having severe gum problems. Now, this was really verging on torture. Normally, a person like this would be granted bail. In fact, several times bail applications were made. You know, if you're a violent Jamaican gangster, you can probably get bail. Not Ernst Zundel, never broke the law in Canada, nothing like that. He couldn't get bail for love or money. He couldn't get bail at all. Completely unjust. Now you wonder, okay, if Zundel did get bail and he fled the country, would that be bad? Well, no, they wanted him out of the country. none of this made sense. It made sense only in hard-nosed hatred for a German and for what he believed in. So after 2 years, Judge Blais did what he was supposed to do and found Ernst Zundel to be a threat to national security. A special plane was hired. We're not sure by whom. Probably the Canadian government. Probably at the cost of $100,000. Ernst, in handcuffs, was whisked away in March of 2005 to Germany. In Germany, he was put on trial defaming the memory of the dead. That's right. He was didn't believe in the new religion of the Holocaust. He got the max. 5 years in prison, which he served in Mannheim prison. One of his lawyers, Sylvia Stoltz, was sent to jail for defending him too vigorously. You know what a broken country Germany is when you can be charged with being too vigorous a lawyer. Now, the worry a lot of people have is their lawyer isn't dedicated enough. No, the problem with Sylvia Stoltz is she was too dedicated, so she drew time in prison. Ernst eventually got out in 2010 and was under severe parole conditions and essentially went silent. The personal tragedy was even greater. Ingrid Rimland, his wife Ingrid Zundel, because she runs the Zundel site, had good reason to fear that if she went to Europe, she would join Ernst in jail. Ernst was not allowed back into the United States. And I'm going to continue this story tomorrow, finish it off, and give you some of the initial reactions to that story so far. There are some wonderful tributes some nasty, just nasty garbage from some of the lamestream media as well. I'll back with you again tomorrow. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Tomorrow, lots more news and views for our people. And the show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of these are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.